Welcome to The Better Build, a podcast that explores the world of software engineering leadership and the people who are shaping it. Let's get to the episode.
Hey, Kai, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. So welcome to our podcast, The Better Build, where we want to explore the world of software engineering leadership and the people who are shaping it. I'm Stéphane. I'm the CEO at Mission. I'm going to be your host today, along with my co-founder and CTO, Fred Bruno.
Yes.
Nice to meet both of you, Stéphane and Fred.
Of course, super happy to be here with you today. You're a seasoned engineering leader. You live in California. You're currently the CTO at User Testing, which helps organizations get insight about their products from customers, so from creation to execution. Decent-sized company, around 1,000 people, right?
Yep.
Prior to that, you started your career in the 90s. You've been leading engineering and product at iconic companies like SAP, Oracle, and just prior to User Testing, you've been the VP and CPO at 4C, a leader in voice of customer solution, where you've been working on big data, machine learning, artificial intelligence. And I think that's a topic we want to tackle today. We'll dive into your journey from your early days as a system analyst to your current CTO role at User Testing. Also, we will talk about AI, how you've been using AI in your different companies, what are the pros and cons you're seeing. And finally, we'll talk about how you see AI maybe reshaping the software engineering industry. So enough talking for me. Kai, tell us about your story.
Yeah, so I'm Kai Vandelo, Chief Technology Officer at User Testing, born and raised in Sweden, spent about half of my life in Europe between Sweden and Germany, and half of my life in the US, in San Francisco, California. I've been in software, specifically enterprise software, since I joined SAP sometime in the first half of the 90s. I came from a background where I had been part of doing an SAP implementation. So I knew the system as a user and I really liked what I saw, what it could do to the business. So when I had the opportunity to join SAP, I asked them, what's your core business? They said, software development. I said, okay, then I want to do software development. I was in Sweden at the time. And they said, okay, then you have to move to Germany. I said, okay, then I moved to Germany. I had this desire to be part of the company and to be part of what's most important to them, which was the software development. And it was an amazing experience. I spent 2 years in Germany as a developer, but we had the title system analyst, which when we get to talking about the impact of AI, I think that actually matters because we were certainly not coders. We spent a lot of our time as a developer with customers. These first 2 years and later as well, really helped shape my view of how software development should work. We spent a lot of time with customers. We had a fantastic tool set that allowed us to translate what we had learned from customer conversations into code. Mm-hmm. And then we took this back and we led the pilot implementations at the first one or two customers who had given us input. We then took this new feature in the product out and led the pilot implementation. So we had this whole closed loop between understanding what the customer is trying to achieve, actually building software for it, and then seeing it implemented. So this has greatly shaped my view of software development. So after 2 years in Germany, SAP sent me as far away as you could get in the SAP universe back then, which was we opened a new development team here outside of San Francisco. It's one of the first application developers to build a vertical and industry solution for the aerospace and defense industry.
Wow. Here in California?
In California, it was something was strategically important to us. And also one of the SAP founders understood that the center of gravity for the aerospace and defense industry is in the US. So we said, we're going to put an application development team in the US, which was a new idea back then. Pretty much all the other developers fitted in one building in Waldorf in Germany, where it was very easy to work directly. You wanted something, you just walked over to their office, you went for a coffee in the coffee corner, and it was all based on personal relationships. And suddenly I find myself out here, 9 time zones away, and with a small team that does not have the contacts back at headquarters. So that was another interesting thing, to be in a brand new location, far away from headquarters, far away from all the expertise, and having to build out the development team, build a new part of the product that heavily depended on what was happening at headquarters. So that's another big lesson learned about how do you work across time zones, how do you work across cultures, how do you work across different backgrounds of people.
Did you have more freedom to be isolated from the HQ?
In a way, you had more freedom, but it also is a bit of a challenge because we depended heavily on what the core product that was being built at the HQ. We had like hundreds of developers there, and we were a team of 5 and maybe later 10 trying to make something out of this big product tailored towards, in our case, the aerospace and defense industry. So yes, a bit more freedom, but also a huge dependency that you had to manage.
The difference in culture as well, because I know in Europe and US, the way to work is totally different. The way to managing people is also totally different. So it's a big adaptation, right?
Yes, it was very interesting. I think for me, already having moved between Sweden and Germany was a little easier maybe than for some others to adapt to a third way of working. So it went pretty well. We built our industry solution, and I ended up spending about 10 years with SAP here in California, first and close to the city. And then we moved down to Palo Alto and opened SAP Labs down there, and it's a pretty big operation now. But I spent about 10 years with SAP here until I realized this is silly that I move here from Europe. I live in San Francisco. I drive down to Palo Alto, like I'm in Silicon Valley, and I've spent 10 years working for a European company with its own little ecosystems. I said, I want to go outside of this. I want to work for a venture capital funded company and really see what Silicon Valley is about.
I have a question about that. Do you think that you did not make that move earlier because you did not think you were comfortable enough as an immigrant? Is that something that at a time that mattered for you?
I think there was some of that, plus that, and I'll come back to it. But I think SAP also had this huge gravity, and I really enjoyed what I was doing. I was having fun. I never looked around much. And every now and then I was approached by, in the dot-com era, by some recruiters or some founders who had some crazy dot-com idea. And I looked at that and I said, but that's complete nonsense. Yes, most of it was nonsense. And I felt what we were building was so real. So I knew the value for the customer. I couldn't quite see the value in a dog walking website or whatever it was people came with, or like a website for super exclusive wines. It's like, how big is that market? I was so used to this enterprise software thinking. So there was a little bit of fear, maybe. And then once I started looking around a little, I made a big mistake. I could not explain to anybody what my value really would be. I thought I was pretty successful at SAP, and I knew how to develop software and how to innovate and build leading edge stuff. But I remember I had lunch with a VC in Palo Alto, whom somebody had introduced me to. And I said, yeah, I'm interested in leading development somewhere. And he goes, what do you bring? And I said, I can lead development. But I could not articulate why I would be better than anybody else or what my method for doing things is. I had never thought about that. It's something I think if you're at that point in your career, you really have to think about what is your method? What can you do? What can you bring? I hadn't thought about that either. I thought, hey, I just want to go run some development somewhere. I hadn't thought about in what kind of company or in what kind of context could I actually add value.
It's actually very interesting because not a lot of people talk about this. It's always hard to sell yourself, right? But you're right. In Silicon Valley, especially, you have a lot of competition, a lot of people, massive amount of people. And Americans are really pragmatics. And usually they're not a big fan of all the big layers and all the big management and everything. But especially for a company from SAP, it's totally different methodologies than startups. Usually in startups, a lot of people are really hands-on, especially at the beginning. So being able to express what you want to do, we've all been there at some point. So it's super interesting to see that even somebody as experienced as you came to the realization that you have to look inside of you to really understand what are your skills, your hardcore skills, right?
Yeah. At the same time, you know what? It reminds me what Steve Jobs said about managers. He said the best leaders are the ones who never wanted the job. And by extrapolation, if you never wanted a job, you probably never thought about the right way to sell yourself. We see that again and again because we've been in the industry for a very long time with Fred leading teams, and we've seen the best engineer we've been working with. They are terrible at selling themselves.
I don't think, again, I'm Swedish, we don't sell ourselves in any way, but at least you have to be able to explain.
Yeah, sure.
About yeah. yourself.
So what did you end up doing?
I got very lucky, got very fortunate that I was working while I was still at SAP with an SAP partner that was a Series C VC funded company in what we now call the IoT, the Internet of Things space. They were working with a lot of SAP customers on very exciting solutions. I happened to know one of those customers very well. So I ended up in some meetings between SAP, the startup, and this joint customer. And then it turned out that they were looking for a VP engineering or CTO. That was pure luck that I really didn't have to sell myself. The startup name is Questra. And their CEO, Emil, he really saw that he could benefit greatly from somebody with my background. So I didn't really need to sell myself particularly hard. And I didn't need to try to be somebody I'm not, fortunately. I was there for 2 years. I really enjoyed this Series C startup where everything was in flux. I had to cover everything from product innovation to just getting the quality of the product. It was a little bit buggy when I joined. And we had some issues with the processes where every time we shipped the patch, it broke something else. And we got all of that going. It was great. And we ended up getting acquired by a somewhat larger competitor that then later got acquired. So the software, some of it still lives on. And this was back in 2006. But that was my first foray into the non-SAP world. From there on, things got much easier because then people could look at my background and say, you've been VP engineering at a Series C startup and we're looking for a VP engineering or a CTO for our Series C startup. It was changing that path that was a big step, maybe the hardest one. From there on, everything has been relatively easy. Like it's been through network, through contacts, people I worked with before went on to a new company and then suddenly had a need and they thought of me. So it's been one change after the other, but it's been usually through just personal contacts.
This is the hardest, right? Having the pedigree to be able to prove actually that you can work in this company. Yeah, most of this company, that's always been my feeling, especially in Silicon Valley, you need to have this badge of honor that you already did the job. They really like to hire the specialist. So having somebody from the outside, especially a different culture and everything, that's a big step up to take the risk.
One thing I've found helpful and that I would advise people in this similar situation, if you know what you want to do, but other people don't seem to see you as the perfect fit, is think about your dream position. And it can be more than one. It could be maybe you want to be VP engineering in a larger company, or you want to be CTO of a smaller one, whatever it is, you can make multiple of these. And then go through your resume and rewrite it for this position. And how would you describe your experience? Not lying, not making things up, but how would you describe the experience you've had so that it matches what your dream position would be? And I think that's an exercise I enjoy. I think it's a good way to think about how to think about yourself, how to think about your skills. And yes, you can call it how to sell yourself if you want, but it's your experience and how to describe it so it matches where you want to go.
That's great advice.
Yeah, that's a good advice. That's not easy to do. It's always easier when you have somebody from the outside asking you the right question, but the introspection is always really hard, especially in engineering, because it's a field so large with so many different expectations of responsibility and everything. Every project is different. Every company is different. Every culture is different. And a VP engineering at a company might not be the VP engineering at another one. It's not like a box where you can fit. So it's a really complicated. I always find that it's a really complicated job, except if you're a software engineer in a very specific field, which is really easy to describe. Sometimes you don't fit because the puzzle piece doesn't fit.
When you're trying to do that exercise and doing some introspection, I think it's particularly difficult because as an engineer or even as a team lead, it's hard to know what was minor and major when you are coding on when you have to do this very complex piece of code that works. It's very tangible that you have achieved something and you can probably be proud, you can talk about it. But when you have to talk about the organizational challenge, conflict between a human in a team and how you resolve it, sometimes it's hard to sell that, especially for us engineers. I think when you come from a business school, you learn how to do that, right? And you learn how to explain to people what you did particularly well in that particular situation. But us engineer, it's management. It's not the real problem. The real problem is building the software, right?
The Better Build is brought to you by Mission. Mission is an award-winning network of senior-level software engineers and product builders, backed by a platform that helps engineers continue to learn, grow, and connect. To get your team of fully managed, fully remote, and fully flexible software engineers, or to join our community, visit us at mission.dev.
I think that is something as engineers or managers in the engineering world, I think it's helpful to go back, think about your experiences and reflect on what can you take away from these. If you would have asked me after my 2 years at SAP in Germany what I learned or my big takeaways, I would have told you about the features I developed. We had this amazing model of collaborating with customers, and it took me maybe 10 years to realize that was perhaps the biggest learning from back then. It was not coding skills. It was not shipping features. It was really how did the whole organization operate? And I now very often reflect back on those first few years that I had, and I understand how the company was operating, and I now understand how important a lot of that stuff was that back then, it was just how we did things. I think it's very worthwhile to go back and reflect a little bit on a meta level. Not what did you deliver? Whom did you work with? But as you said, were there interpersonal conflicts that got resolved? Or why did the company succeed? Or why did it not succeed for them? Outside of just exactly what did I do?
I see. You're absolutely right.
We all went through that exactly. Yeah. So after that, you've been working at the company called 4C, right?
Yeah, landed at 4C. There was also after Questia, I spent a bit of time at SAP again. And then I went to Clairemail, which was a very cool mobile banking company when mobile banking was the hottest thing, when every bank suddenly woke up and needed a mobile strategy. We had a product that met their needs. So that was an amazing rocket ship to try to hold on to. And we were like doubling in size each year. And I was pretty cool time. We sold that to a British company. It was an interesting learning as well about, again, difference in company models. We were like a classic Silicon Valley software company, and they had much more of a service model where they did a lot of custom work for large clients, very different models that clashed a little. The companies were almost of equal size. The acquiring one was about twice the size of ours. And that merger taught me a lot about how do you set goals? How do you mix teams together? Because I ended up running engineering for the combined entity. So there was a lot of interesting things to be taken away from that as well, beyond just all the fun of building software that blew off the shelves and that our customers loved suddenly being able to bank on their mobile phones. So that was a pretty cool time. After that, I spent a few years at Oracle and then joined 4C as the CEO from the mobile banking company, became the CEO of 4C. So he sat in my kitchen one day and over a glass of wine said, "You really should come here. This is really cool. We're set up for great growth in the whole voice of customer space. It's a growing segment. We've got the right investors. It's going to be fun." I joined him again.
Can you talk a bit about what 4C is doing and what is voice of customer solutions?
4C was a true pioneer in surveys, especially online intercept surveys. If you're on a website and you get asked about your experience, and it was founded, remember, I think in the early 2000s when the web was a bit of a wild west, and it was very difficult for people building websites to know. There were no web analytics. It was very difficult to know what do people think about this. And the founders had the foresight to build a survey solution that would give you feedback about what people think about your website. And then through some acquisitions and change of ownership, it had lost a little bit of its focus. But it's basically a pretty set up survey company. But it had all kinds of issues. The technology had fallen behind a little. The product was very niche and the usability of it was very poor. So it often came with service delivery that we had people who used the software on behalf of our customers. And so we changed all of that. I spent about 3 years there. We built a pretty complete suite of round surveys with a lot of little feedback buttons that you see on websites where you can leave unsolicited feedback. We built out a lot of machine learning capabilities, built out a data platform. We had a lot of data from these surveys, huge volumes. built out a data platform, built some machine learning capabilities to detect anomalies in the data, to analyze automatically what's driving these anomalies. So we tried to take the time of analysis down so that you didn't have to sit and look at your survey data for a week to understand what happened a week ago. So we tried to automate a lot of that. So that was great. We ended up selling the company to Verint, large software company that I think was very unusual for them. They actually, instead of moving our application to their platforms, they kept our platform and moved other applications they had acquired on to our platform.
Because yours was better.
Yeah, because it was ahead of what they had. And then now I've been at user testing for about 5 years. And one of the first things I did was I looked at the product and what it was doing. And I realized it has a lot of data that is not going used. So did same thing again, built out the data platform, hired some machine learning engineers, and back in 2019, started building out machine learning capabilities. And for the longest time, I was telling people, don't call it AI. It's called machine learning. AI is some marketing term. We should not use that.
It's still true to this day.
Yes, but I lost that battle. Now
I know everybody did.
Now everybody calls it AI. I've given up.
You have to be part of the thing, but yeah, you're right. A lot of machine learning techniques which are qualified by AI are not even machine learning. It's under the same umbrella.
It sounds great. And in many cases, it is great. Back then, we started shipping our first, here at user testing, our first machine learning based features in late 2019 or early 2020. And the first thing we built was not by today's standards, very modest. It was sentiment analysis on where we could find whether people had a strong positive or negative sentiment in the feedback they were giving about an experience. And we were so timid about this, we called it suggested sentiment. Good thing is we built a feedback loop in from day one where the user could say, this is positive or this is incorrect. You have labeled it incorrectly, and then it would disappear. And that is something I think anybody building anything based on machine learning or AI, really thinking about how can you still give the user control, keep the user in control of what they're doing. I think it's fantastic to use AI to speed up things, to automate things. But if there is a user in the loop still, let them be in control and let them be able to say, this is right, this is wrong. That I think is going to be a big part of successful adoption of AI or an AI-powered product is that users don't view it as a completely black box. We have one big principle here at user testing now, which is when we put AI into the product, we always show links back to the sources. Why did our AI say what it says?
Oh, yeah.
We always go in and look at the source. So if you're questioning it, go check for yourself.
To me, actually, the first iteration, the first version of this ChatGPT, it was the real problem. Me not being able to go back to the source. It changes completely the experience I had with ChatGPT when I'm asking him something really precise and accurate on the internet. I want to know where it's coming from.
We've probably all done this with our navigation systems, whether you use it in your car or on your phone. All of us have canceled, put in the same target again to see if it gives us a new route, because it doesn't tell you why it picked the route it picked. It's this black box that tells me how to get to where I want to go, but doesn't tell me why. We all do this. We cancel and put in the same target, and then we see what it says. And sometimes it changes its mind, and I don't know why. Sometimes it gives me the same answer. I still don't know why.
Yeah, that's interesting. We're still at the beginning of understanding how we're going to interact with these things. And you're right, the black box is a bit of a problem. But can you use the data back to that model to retrain? After that, you get all the data back to give it a sense of what's wrong. So you can introduce a bias, or you're correcting the bias of the model.
That's the amazing thing about such a feedback loop, is that you can constantly, you know which areas your model needs to be retrained in, and you have now more labeled data. So it gives the user more control, and it gives the software company more labeled data to train the models better. Building a feedback loop into anything. I would not want to show output of the machine learning models without linking back to the sources and without giving the user the ability to give feedback.
That's interesting. At user testing, what are the place where you use ML? Is it, of course, in the main product? But I think we were talking before, you also use it internally for internal tools, for developer and everything, so it's spread out, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's a little newer effort. As I said, I've probably been working since 20, 17 or something on building data platform, building machine learning, building AI, if you want, into products. And I think in this last year, it's been amazing to see the explosion of AI-powered tools that we can use for software development. And I'm convinced this is going to fundamentally change how software development happens. And I think this change is happening now.
In your experience of using these tools, maybe you can explain a couple of tools that you've been using or the domain where maybe news, what was the success or the impact or the challenge to put that in place? Because as you said, some tools, if they're as disruptive as we all think it might be, it will be a lot of change for the job of being a software engineer, right?
I think like many others, we're using Copilot.
Yeah, absolutely. We use it, but too, in our company, of course.
Which I find just amazing. We got a demo from GitHub where they were showing us some use cases for Copilot. And there were many things I had not thought of beyond just coding faster with the adoption of Copilot. But there are many similar tools out there. So don't get hung up on Copilot specifically. You not only can you code faster. One thing I love about our security team is they are watching this and seeing it as an opportunity to write more secure code. How can we teach this thing about our security standard? It's already pretty good. It already knows the OWASP 10 standards and different from humans. It doesn't forget a whole lot. It's not just we can code faster. I think we can code better. We can code more secure. But I think big thing for maybe especially for us as leaders in this space is that we need to think about how do we work? Because just coding faster doesn't necessarily reduce cycle times much. I think we have to rethink the relationship between product management, design, engineering. We have to rethink, like, how do I get my requirements? How do I know that I'm done? How can we change the model so that we get to much shorter cycle times thanks to these tools?
You're right. And software engineering, it doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? Even if you're the same person doing it in your head, actually you have different roles. So acquiring the requirement, as you said, building the right product. If you go faster, but in the wrong direction, it doesn't help you. And same thing, like, what are you done? The definition of done, but a lot of process have been trying to put that in place. Yeah, AI for now, it's really verticalized in a very specific thin slice of the profession. But to be disruptive, I think you have to touch other professions around software engineering, as you said.
And you need to look at not what roles and what titles do we have today, but what is the work that's being done? And we reshuffle this and what of it can we automate and what of it do we need to still have humans do? And do they do the exact same thing? They do things differently. And somewhat ironically, I believe is going to bring us back to a bit more how we worked at SAP in the early 90s, when we didn't have product managers. We didn't have much design. We didn't have quality engineers. As a system analyst, you did all of these things and you wrote code. Yeah. And the coding can get automated, but the overall engineering doesn't get automated. You still need to be able to break problems down into smaller components. You need to find solutions for each. You need to think about reuse. You need to understand how you can assemble existing building blocks with what you're building now, how that all together forms a solution. That level of engineering, I think we still need. Coding gets automated.
When I was working in the 90s, we didn't have that kind of roles. Didn't exist. Product manager was not even a term. Project manager maybe, but it was some kind of a weird shift because project manager, especially in Europe, it was a very standardized profession that didn't apply well in software engineering. So most engineering were doing the work themselves.
Yep.
They were disputing, defining the requirement. They just had a goal in the future. They will decide for everything. In the Silicon Valley companies, they have a way to organize engineering that I've never seen in Europe. It's a different way to organize this pod of engineers, engineering manager with the group of engineer.
I agree with everything you said. And within engineering, we've created all these layers. We have front-end engineers and back-end engineers and database engineers and API engineers and
DevOps and everything. Yeah.
DevOps and it's like, cannot one person do all of this? But the technology all got so complicated. I'm a front-end engineer. I have to learn frameworks, and every 6 months there's a new framework. But if we automate that, if Copilot or any tool like that knows the frameworks and knows how to code, maybe the engineers can go back and be true full-stack engineers again, who think about everything from the data model to the user interface, from the business logic to how to call it from the outside through APIs. And that's my big hope, that we can get this unified again. I think that allows us to move faster.
And before it was possible because software was smaller.
Yep.
So we didn't need smaller teams and one person would have a lot of impact, the whole spectrum of the surface that you had to touch. I remember in the 1930s, a small team for the project I was working on, very few engineers, but we knew end to end from the deployment to the database, to the front end, to the APIs. Everything was on our heads.
And if we get the technical difficulties out of it through automation, through all of these tools, then hopefully we can get back to this ownership where you have an engineer or system analyst who understands all of these things and who can really then get back to this, talking to customers, solving the problem, bringing in the solution to customers. Hopefully we can get back to that. I think that would be amazing for the software engineering profession to break up a little bit of this specialization.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's great. I want to ask you a last two questions on that particular topic. And I want to quote you first. You wrote a pretty interesting article that's available on your LinkedIn page about AI and how it's going to change how we work as engineers. I find it super interesting. You're describing your early days at SAP, and you say, despite the absence of AI tools, our proprietary language, IDE, toolkit, and app server made coding straightforward. So our focus was on engaging with customers, collaborating on high-level design, leveraging each other's expertise, and crafting outstanding software. Looking forward, I find ourselves revisiting the core principle of that era, armed with the new tools and technologies that enable unprecedented innovation. So I really like this extract. The thing is, we, the three of us, I think we come from a world where we had to code pretty much everything, right, by ourselves. But then we've seen all of this evolution in the last 20 years. New abstraction layers have been created, frameworks, libraries. We had the cloud revolution where we went from build to deal with physical bare metal servers to just web interface. We are already using for now a long time version control system, right? My point with all of that is that I think we are already a pretty optimized function in a company compared to other function. What makes you think that this AI revolution is going to be even more significant in terms of development, productivity? And if you think that the order of magnitude this Gen AI development tool are going to bring is bigger than anything else, what are your advice for the younger generation, both for developers but also managers and leaders?
The first part of that question, why this is different from other changes, I think it's because it truly allows us to work differently. Whenever with SaaS, we were still developing software and deploying it. It's just we had to deploy it in one place instead of making DVDs and ship them. But it was still a lot of the same thing. And with version control and stuff, they're just things that have helped us do what we already do better. I think with AI, yes, it can help us do what we already do better, faster, as we talked about before. If we can use it to rethink how we work. And again, I think that maybe the easiest thing to imagine is that everybody becomes a full stack developer and owns a piece of functionality as opposed to a piece of code, because the code has been written by a machine. Yes, as a human, I'm still responsible for the code that the machine helped me write, but I can take on much higher level responsibilities. I can take on the responsibility that this functionality does what it's supposed to do. And I can also go outside of that and define what it's supposed to do and make sure it does that. So I think it has this ability to change how we work, how we interact between developers and customers. That's the big thing. And then the advice for a younger generation, I think, is to wholeheartedly embrace this. First of all, coding skills, I think, are very quickly becoming irrelevant. If your claim to fame is that you can write better front-end React code than anybody else, or that your Java back-end code is the fastest, forget about it. I'm sorry. I think I was a good coder, but it's not what helped me do more interesting things over time. Not my coding skills. It was this holistic ownership, really understanding what's the customer trying to achieve and how can we help them achieve what they want to achieve. And I think that's something I would very much advise a younger generation is don't get hung up on your coding skills. They are not going to be helping you going forward. Try to understand the end-to-end. Yes, you should be good at using these tools, but they're getting so easy to use, that's not going to set you apart either. train your business understanding and trigger your curiosity. I think any good developer wants to know, so why does the customer do this?
Yeah, you're right. I think that's one of the biggest difference between, it's not junior and senior, that kind of thing, but actually the best engineer that I know care about the outcome. Whether some other engineers, they care about the craft, they care about the code. The outcome doesn't matter. As long as the engineering best practice has been respected, the code is written the way it is, that's what they love doing. And some of the engineers, they really see the code as just a medium for the outcome. People that don't really like writing code, they can accept some mistakes and some shortcuts in order to achieve the outcome. And this is the kind of people where AI will be a godsend to them because they don't need to deal with this.
And they are a godsend to AI because we still need
the thinking of the outcome and actually how can they with systems.
Exactly. I would say as a younger engineer, really focus on outcomes, ask the why questions all the time, not the how. Why do we do this? Why is this a good thing? It's important also for us as leaders. I think maybe over the past decade or two, often as we have brought younger talent and new graduates into our companies, we've started them off with coding for coding's sake. And I think we need to change that. We need to find a way to get the new graduates. We still need new thinking. We still need new talent. And we have to find ways to get them up to speed and productive in this new world where the coding skills are not differentiating.
And I think maybe we got a new definition, but as I was saying, the two categories of engineers, they're labeled engineers. But for me, you have the difference between what I call a product engineer, which is somebody that really focuses on the outcome, versus a system engineer, somebody that focuses on the tech itself, which we need to. Somebody that can focus on the tech, but we also need, in the end, people that understand the outcome and the product engineering. When you go to the studies and everything, product aspect is never taught. That's something that I learned on the field by failing and succeeding and everything. It's something that's probably never taught. There's no school for this. It's a bit obscure. Engineering, the hard skills are always taught, but the rest, which is most important, is never taught. It's fundamental. Maybe it's going to bring a fundamental change even to education about what we think about building software.
I think what we as engineering and product leaders need to figure out, how can we help the people in our organizations become more of what you call the product engineer?
Yeah, it's super interesting because even right now it's really potentially disruptive. Yes, AI on the product that we use are not like to the state where we can implement this already. But as you said, you can see already the path being defined as we speak with all the evolutions, as you said.
I think it's here now and it's up to us to understand what to do with it.
Yeah, you're right.
100%. Gentlemen, it was a delightful discussion. Really enjoy it.
Yeah.
For the people listening to us, if they want to reach out, LinkedIn.
That is fine. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's Kai Van De Loo.
You got it.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch soon.
Absolutely.
We'd like to thank our guest for joining us today, for all of you for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred listening service. Stay connected with us on LinkedIn and visit our website, mission.dev, for more information on our network and platform. See you next episode.